Welcome back to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast summer editions. I'm calling this Part 2 Palooza. We'll be picking up where we left off with the second halves to the second half of Season 2 episodes of the show. First up is the continuation of my conversation with Rolando Pujol, the retrologist, who talked to me about Howard Johnson's and Holiday Inn. If you'd like to go back and brush up, Part 1 came out on December 15th, 2022. Now, just like other aspects of Roadside Americana, after recording this episode with Rolando, I kept noticing references to Hojo's and Holiday Inn here and there. For instance, I recorded an episode for another podcast about, surprisingly, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and while doing show prep was reminded that their very first issue was the highlight of the mini-con held at Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge on the Portsmouth Traffic Circle here in New Hampshire. A few months later, I hosted a podcast karaoke at a diner on that traffic circle, which happens to be right next door to a Holiday Inn and around the corner from the same Hojo's. Then, while I was enjoying the Sun Records-centered Million Dollar Quartet jukebox musical this spring, narrator Sam Phillips mentions that he just got in on the ground floor of a new motel chain from Memphis called Holiday Inn, evoking an ironic chuckle from the audience. This is not only absolutely true, Phillips became so involved in the chain that he even ran the Holiday Inn record label after his friend and the hotel line's founder, Kemmons Wilson, left the record company to pursue other interests. And that's just a small example of what discussing interesting topics can do. Anyhow, on to part two. The appearance of the architecture and the, you know, the cosmetics of those buildings kind of inspired your, or at least piqued your interest at a young age, and you said, wow, that's unique, and it kind of crossed between, you know, the lines when I was talking earlier with the gentleman from Christmas Story House. You know, we were talking about how that post-World War II urban renewal movement of like out with the old, in with the new really kind of took over the country. And I gotta say that, you know, there's nobody I could look at, especially Howard Johnson's, and be like, yeah, that's old. I mean, it looks almost cartoonish. It's straight from, you know, the 50s, you know, the post-World War II era, at least. You know, it's so like outlandish.
It's so outlandish, you know, but and it's funny. I mean, it was something that was designed to attract attention, and it did. And it was designed to, there was a lot of research that went into that. I mean, Howard Johnson was very careful in everything that he did, very strategic. And, it connotes for people, for those who grew up with it, you know, I mean, or in the shadow of that era. Because, I mean, I was born in the 70s. So I caught the tail end of Hojo's still being Hojo's before the company got sold multiple times and broken up, and the hotels got separated from the restaurants, and it gets really complicated from there. But there was great meaning in that for people. But then at the same time, you know, if a company does not find a way to refresh the brand while still being true to its roots, understanding where it came from, what made it a success, but also adapting to what's coming and to changing tastes, it's going to run into trouble. Yeah. And that's kind of the pickle that Howard Johnson found itself in the early and mid 80s, you know, when their restaurants were looking pretty dated. They were really seen and not in a favorable way as a throwback to the 50s and 60s and maybe even 40s. There were some locations that hadn't been touched in many decades.
Yeah.
And the whole world around them was changing. They had experimented with different styles. For example, in 1965, there was the famous Concept 65, which was famously rolled out in Plattsburgh. That was like the one that you probably visited back in the day. That's the one that Don Draper visits, right? The one that brought, sort of fused the gatehouse from the motor lodges and sort of rammed it into the restaurant itself, you know? So they were experimenting with things, certainly. They even experimented with a fast food version of Howard Johnson called Hojo's Junction. and the idea for that was to, you would go into this Hojo's Junction, which was kind of like, again, that traditional gatehouse gatehouse A-frame style design, go in, and it was self-service. I mean, you would have food to go, or you could eat it there. There was a dining room, and it was an acknowledgement by Hojo's that, you know, we got to keep an eye on what McDonald's and Burger King and KFC, yeah, what these guys are doing. But they never quite got their arms around this whole idea that, you know, we really need to be worried about fast food, because we are not fast food. We're actually developing a reputation for being slow food. So by the 80s, that sort of like that iconic Howard Johnson signage and certainly the restaurant design, the motel lodge design, is starting to feel a little bit dated. And they didn't really, you know, stay with the times. I mean, it is interesting that Howard Deering Johnson, had he not died in 1972, he was only 75. He could have got another decade or two.
Right.
I mean, if he had made it longer, I just have a hard time believing that he would have let the company be sold to a British conglomerate and then sort of like have the rapid collapse that it experienced in the 1980s. He would have said, like, what are we doing about this McDonald's? What are we doing about Burger King? People are changing their tastes. Our restaurants are getting old. We're compromising on food quality. What, are you crazy? You can't do this. None other than the great French chef, Jacques Pepin, you know, who with Pierre Frenet worked for Howard Johnson at his famous commissary here in Queens, not far from where I live, and really elevated the quality of food at the insistence of Howard Johnson, who would like show up at the test kitchens and really had a great command for every aspect of the operation and the quality that it had to maintain. Pepin, in his autobiography, talks about how the son, Howard Brennan Johnson, just didn't get it. You know, the company, with the loss of Howard Deering Johnson, the dad, the company lost its reason for being. And the son was more focused on, knew his way better around a spreadsheet and all of his Ivy League educated cohorts than they did a kitchen, than they did the dining room. And that this in and of itself, in addition to the changing America around it, was the seed of the chain's destruction. They just... had they been less focused on managing costs and maintaining an annual profit, which became the overriding focus after Hojo's went public in 1961, which was another moment that would eventually create tension and troubles. Once you're public, you've got to start managing your costs in a different way, right? It basically, you know, everything that we look back now with such nostalgia and warmth for the old Hojo's, by the 80s, it just looked really tired.
Yeah.
You know, and that's sort of the same thing that Holiday Inn was doing when its motor lodges, which dated way back to the first one in Memphis in 1952, you know, they were getting tired as well. They even had this famous print ad, which I could send you the link for your show notes, that shows, you know, the brand new Hojo sign for the 1980s. And it shows a tiny version of the great sign and says, we're moving away from this. It's a new Hojo's for the, not Hojo's, Holiday Inn for the 80s. So both brands were dealing with these problems in sort of different ways. Yeah. But Holiday Inn seems to have survived the transition a little bit better. Hojo's just collapsed. The restaurants have all gone away. The very last one that was a shadow of, wasn't really a Howard Johnson. It was just a Howard Johnson in name, closed earlier this year in Lake George, one that I visited three times. And then and of course the hotel survived as part of the Wyndham empire. But if you go to Wyndham's website and look for Howard Johnson's, the Howard Johnson logo is one of many little brands.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like toward the middle of the pack. I mean, it's really sad.
It is.
That it all came to that. And it didn't necessarily have to. Like, one of the things that I get really frustrated about, which you will read if you go through my Instagram account. I mean, I'm constantly giving McDonald's a hard time for knocking down their old buildings and putting up the McBoxes and getting rid of the Hamburglar and McDonaldland. But yet there is really smart strategy behind that, because they have found a way to remain relevant. You know, they haven't allowed themselves to fall into the trap of not changing for fear of alienating their core audience. They have managed to keep the brand fresh. I think they've gone too far in the direction away from nostalgia and heritage. And we've seen a couple of things this year that have brought them back to that, like the retro Happy Meals, for example, the return of
the pumpkins,
Halloween shows, right? The punk, exactly, which I have a couple in my kitchen I could show you, you know, but they have managed to stay fresh. There was good management, and they were able to correct when they were starting to get soft and when they were starting to get stuck and people were starting to say, yeah, McDonald's is old and tired. They did innovate. So I don't give them nearly enough credit on my Instagram for that, but then that's also not a very popular opinion.
Right.
But everybody wants the McDonald's of their child.
I'm kind of wondering if the reason why Holiday Inn was able to, I guess, considering that they arrived when they did, when, you know, I realized Howard Johnson's was still going strong in the early 50s, but that overlap, it's almost like the trajectory that Holiday Inn took there. It's almost, you could break it down almost just the symbols alone and even the font, like Holiday Inn, if you keep it uniform letter size and then add a little express, you know, nice, like simple, sleek looking express at the end, it doesn't seem as dated. But even, you know, the last few Howard Johnsons that exist, they try to do that. The sign says Howard Johnson's in just a little, you know, kind of like subtle, understated way, but it's still like, yeah, and you have a giant orange roof. You know, it's like, it's not, and the simple Simon and the pie, you know, pie man, and then, you know, that was, that couldn't look any more early 20th century, you know, that silhouette.
No.
You know, it doesn't carry over well. It's not like, you know, the RCA dog, which you can kind of, you know, when you, when you look at the early versions of, what do you call it? The Victrola, you know, with the dogs there, you know, it's very turn of the century. It's very 19th, early 20th, but then they really bring it up to date. They keep it modern. But you can't do that with, and so when they introduced the lamplighter figure, I don't think it was the same artist that created both, right? It's a new, and he's, but he's trying to match
it. I don't believe so.
Merging him into that family, merging him into the family. And it's like, yeah, that's, I know you're doing this for consistency purposes, but it kind of reminds me of, like, I think the few times that I went to Howard Johnson, seeing those symbols and just being like, I feel like this place is behind in the times. It's not, this isn't 80s, 90s, you know, type place. It's, if it was presented as nostalgia, then I think it would have done better, but it wasn't being presented that way. It was being presented as, yeah, this is a,
and you've hit,
we're
a
competing with other ones.
Because, no, you're absolutely, I know, spot on that, because, you know, the franchise restaurants, when Imperial Group, the British concern, sold Hojo's to Marriott back in the mid 80s, 1985, 1986, Marriott kept the restaurants that were owned by Howard Johnson's and converted most of them to Bob's Big Boy or Roy Rogers or things like that, sold some of them as well. The franchise restaurants and the motor lodges went with another company called Prime Motor Inns. And they ended up eventually spinning off the franchise restaurants into a different organization called the Franchise Associates, which were basically the owners of the franchised Howard Johnson's restaurants, which were near close to 200 at the time in 1986. They were feeling that their needs were not being properly represented. On the one hand, they've been divorced from the corporate stores, and Marriott's turning those into Bob's Big Boy, and Prime Motor Inn is more focused on hotels anyway. So they were afraid they were going to get shut down or orphaned, or in fact, there was, I even found an article that they were being kind of forced. There was talk of them turning into Bob's Big Boys, and they were going to have to pay for the privilege. So they fought back, threatened litigation. They even hired Griffin Bell, who was the former attorney general under Jimmy Carter in the late 70s, and they were able to basically receive the intellectual property for Howard Johnson as it's connected to restaurants and foods, the frozen food business that was also, they had a line of food in supermarkets. And they were able to keep the restaurants as they were and do as they pretty much pleased with them. You know, they maintained a commissary system for a while. They swore up and down that they were going to invest in the properties and market them better and improve the actual infrastructure. But all of that required money.
Right.
And the money wasn't there. And so even the Howard Johnson franchised restaurants, which numbered over 100 in the mid-80s, gradually went away, the same way that the corporate-owned ones that Marriott was turning into Bob's Big Boy or spilling off, those went away. So that we got to this situation for the in the last decade where we were finally down to just three locations, Bangor, Maine, Lake Placid, New York, and then Lake George. And finally, Lake George sort of died with a whimper earlier this year. And I did not mourn it. I mean, I had visited Lake George three times in 2008 when it still had the feel of an old Howard Johnson's, 2015, after it had reopened after a period of being closed under different ownership. And it was definitely on the decline. And then I visited in 2019 one more time against my better judgment. And it was grim. It was
I
really
bet.
grim. And it was that feeling you get when, you know, I mean, this is really hurtful, but it's time for this to die, you
If
know? I mean, and so, yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with Lake George. The Howard Johnson's, it's was it like kind of like near the top of the strip before you start hitting like the actual lakefront area, or
Yeah,
was it closer
it
to
was way up there,
Glens
you know, and it
Falls?
still had the portion of the orange tree.
Yeah,
Yeah. And it had a, it used to have a Howard Johnson's water lodge as well. So
that's right. Okay, that's that, because I was a frequent visitor of the Great Escape. At
oh
growing up,
yeah.
we would go there all the time, and that is another, layered history behind that particular amusement park. It started out as Story Town USA, and for the exact same purposes, they had, that, because Lake George is not terribly far from New York City. You could get people up there, for weekend trips all the time, and it's even beyond, Saratoga. And you had that kind of matriculate into it, and it reminds me a lot because you have, like, to me Lake George is always like that. It's a very historic place. It has, history that goes all the way back 18th century, but it almost had like a plasticky feel to it of very early 20th century. Like they had,
Yeah.
the fort there, Fort William and Mary, Fort William Henry, excuse me. Where
Yeah.
it's a from French and Indian War, and they have reenactments there like you would expect, but it right at the base of it is like arcades and t-shirts shops, and that's where you get
Yeah.
on the boats to go onto the
Frankenstein's
lake,
Wax Museum.
right? It's like,
Yeah.
and it's like, oh yeah, it's almost like, well, there's the haunted house, there's our old colonial fort, and there's like it just like this paradise of. And you don't have to go that far, and there's Frontierland is nearby, but it's not New York State Frontierland. It's like New Mexico Frontierland, but it's in New York. It was just like a vacation land. That whole corridor north of Albany, is just vacation land off the Northway, the very same road that eventually goes
Fantastic.
all the way up to Plattsburgh.
Yeah.
And it's just, what better setting for a Howard Johnson's that lasts and just holds on? Because I think when people still go to Lake George now, it's
So
for that
cool.
nostalgia purpose. They see that as, their old stomping grounds from when, either
That's
they were,
right. It's
it's so
yep.
it's a fun.
It's to get that shop worn 1950s, 60s, you know, yeah. It's
And
fun.
IHOP has
So
a
it's
lot of
funny that
this,
that's where the that's where Howard Johnson's final stand ended up.
right? This last stand, and just
Yeah.
not terribly far from
Oh, IHOP too. IHOP
store
has a
number
long
one.
legacy still.
And that's another business that even just the architecture reminds me a lot of the Hojos, the steep, big cathedral, steep roofs and everything. And that was a pretty standard, we would travel a lot as a kid. My dad was in the Air Force, so we moved around, not as much as some of our friends did and stuff, but enough that we'd have to travel to go see parents, go see in-laws and family and relatives
Right,
and
sure.
stuff. And so we got pretty well known. We knew the interstates pretty well and all the different things. And IHOP was like one of those places late at night, you know, kind of, you know, as our way home or something. Late for me anyway, it was one of those places like, oh, my shoes are off and, you know, I'm getting comfy and I wake up, hey, we're going to get some meat. Okay, you know, and go into this cathedral of pancakes. And, you know, but they had a lot of that same like 60s, you know, holdover stuff. It was the mid 80s, but I'm like, did I go back in time? Like, what is going on here? And it's like the decision that those corporations have to make, like, are we going to try to cash in? Like, if we hold off long enough and remain looking the same long enough, we'll be able to cash in on nostalgia. But if we try too hard to stay in the old days, then people are going to literally bypass us entirely. They're just like, no, we're not going to deal with
it. It is so difficult making those decisions. I mean, I do not envy, you know, the executives in those corporate rooms, you know, who have to make those in those boardrooms, who have to make those decisions about how to evolve the brand while being true to the brand. I mean, recently the easiest thing has been to turn everything into a sleek black glass block, box, and update the logo and make everything feel like a Chipotle. But I think that's sort of been an overreaction. Right now, to put it mildly, right now you could see a Wendy's, a Burger King, and a McDonald's are all lined up right next to each other, and they all look essentially the same. I mean, there's differentiations in color and emphasis on proportion, but basically, you know, it's the same design. Whereas they're no longer marketing by making the building represent the brand,
right.
And I think that's a lost opportunity. It would have been so much more interesting if McDonald's had done what they've done in Europe, which is they have updated their restaurants, but they kept a nod to the mansard roof in these little kind of canopies, and it still looks like a McDonald's, but a freshened up McDonald's.
Right.
It doesn't instinctively annoy me the way that the box does.
You know? I remember when those started showing up, like around, you know, the turn of this century, where it was like, you know, McDonald's closed for 2 weeks or something, and you see them bringing it in on a truck. They're like, "Here's your new McDonald's," and it looks like a shoebox, and it's like, oh. You know, I know you're going for it, but it's the same. It happens all the time. University campuses and, you know, New York State capital, you know, the entire Albany, you know, used to have such. And it's the second time today I brought it up. But I mean, the Empire Plaza is perfect example of like early 50s. Like, let's make this, you know, we're going to have a space age, you know, it's going to look like a spaceship landed right next to the Capitol. And it's like, you have this gorgeous Capitol building.
The egg.
And it's the egg. And you're like, why do you have an egg? You know, it's, and then like this grass is poking up through the cement. And it's just like, oh, come on. Like, couldn't you just leave it a little bit? You know, we couldn't have that. And it is, you put it so well.
Nelson Rockefeller's great vision. So,
right. He could have kept it, but with Holiday Inn, I think it should be mentioned its connection to classic film, because, you know, I wonder if that has any factor at all to the way it has survived. Whereas, and obviously, you know, having a name of a person as your title of your brand isn't necessarily a recipe for good or bad. It could go either way. I mean, McDonald's has lasted forever, and that's an actual family name. From New Hampshire originally.
That's right.
That's actually funny. A few years ago, we went, we use Atlas Obscura obsessively. I'm sure you're familiar with Atlas Obscura.
Oh, it's a fun site. Yeah. It's one of those things that I'm like, why didn't I invent that myself?
Anyway, right. Exactly. Well, your Instagram is like a companion to it. You know, it's like a lot of the same kinds of ideas. And we went and visited,
you should buy me out,
but... I think it was Mac McDonald's, grave site. Well, it's actually in a what do you call it, not sarcophagus, but what a big building that has all the mausoleum. Yeah, thank you. And the mausoleum's in Goffstown, New Hampshire, and it's not hard to find him because there's the McDonald's arch on his headstone. You know, it's awesome. It's like, so it's like branding even
I think Kenon Wilson's has the great sign on his toes.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, so obviously the Howard Johnson's, you know, name isn't a curse, but it's also not a virtue. But I think with Holiday Inn, it's so funny because, you know, as it's being built, the, you know, at least as legend goes, the builder, you know, the surveyor, whatever, architects, you know, kind of jokingly refer to it as Holiday Inn based on the Fred Astaire, Bing Crosby movie. And they're like, yeah, let's stick with that. You know, so it's like, if you ever stay at a Holiday Inn,
let's stick with it.
You are by extension, you know, getting some kind of interaction with Hollywood. You know, it's like, it's a funny, you know, kind of deal there, you know, just demonstrating how the many layers or the cycle of pop culture that it just, you know, this movie was popular enough. And, you know, in those days they really, you know, musicals were the thing because that's how you know, allowed for a movie to endure. And White Christmas comes from that movie. So, you know, and Easter Parade and, you know, all that whole thing. And then it ends up being the name of a hotel chain and a very successful one at that. And so I, you know, when people see like the, you know, in an old movie store, which don't exist anymore, but if they were to see like, oh, Holiday Inn, haha, like the hotel, it's like actually other way around. You know, the hotel is by extension
it's the other way,
you know, from this. And I think with a name like that, it lends itself branding wise and longevity wise to being able to adjust a little bit more with the times. You know, it has that, you know, because I always, I always associated until I learned that it was directly tied to the movie, the same name. I kind of just saw it as like the English version of vacation, you know, holiday, going on holiday. So when you're on holiday, you stay at this inn. But then when I found out there's actually the movie that inspired the name, I'm like, oh, okay, well, it still works. But you know, however it works, as long as it's filling rooms, they don't care, you know, whatever gets people there.
Absolutely.
So,
by the way, you had mentioned earlier that famous quote about being on the highways and you never seeing anything.
Yeah.
So, I did a quick research while we were chatting, and I found this link on the Department of Transportation. Actually, they have a whole blog here, and the actual quote was first said by John Steinbeck, written by John Steinbeck in his famous book with Charlie, In Search of America, which I'm sure you've read, or it's on your list. I've read part of it. It's great. And he goes, when we get these throughways across the whole country, and we must, it will be possible to drive from New York to California without seeing a single thing. Then 30 years later, none other than, you know, one of my great inspirations, Charles Kuralt of CBS from On the Road, he makes a similar observation in one of his books. The interstate highway system is a wonderful thing. It makes it possible to go from coast to coast without seeing anything or meeting anybody, which is
absolutely true. So I mixed up Kuralt and Cronkite. I knew it was a great newsman. It was, and who better to come up with that observation. And it's funny because when we were traveling west last year, we got a really good view of Route 66 from next to Route 66 because I-40 runs parallel to 66. And it's like, and, you know, of I-40. Course, Route 66 is so integral in the Grapes of Wrath. And, you know, it's how the Joads get from Oklahoma to California. And in that era, in the 30s, there was a brand new highway and it makes perfect sense. But when roads are created, it's, you know, the road itself is a reflection of the needs of the people of the time. And so when you have the great expanses of the desert of the West, Route 66 has a very short lifespan. It's really not, it doesn't, you know, it's not long before the country says, no, we need greater roads than that. And it's crazy when you go down Route I-40 and you're like, I remember, I think as soon as we got into, we went over from Texas to New Mexico, we were like, first of all, like, I can't believe I'm in New Mexico right now. This is crazy that I drove here, by the way. But as we pulled off the first exit, and there are so many ghost towns with the old motels that I don't know if, you know, anybody, we weren't going to hang around some of them to find out if there's like
no, right.
or something. creepy. There's a few like spots on Route 66 that are preserved kind of as a historic highway, but the vast majority of it, you could technically drive on it. But there's actually a guy from the town that I live in here in New Hampshire, in Milton, New Hampshire, that in 2020 did all of Route 66 in a model, not a Model T, but another Ford from the 20s. And you know, it took
marvelous.
Him twice as long, but he did get to meet people along the way. He was stopping every, and he even, like, you know, he did the more traditional 66, and he stuck to 66. He didn't hit the interstates. And so, but I'm like, but the rest of us, yeah, you get a really good view of the old roads, kind of like when you're driving the thruway in New York State, you go on I-90, you're right next to the railroad and you're right next to the Erie Canal.
That's right.
You know, it's like these different layers, and each one of them leaves behind their own tavern, hotel, inn.
Yes.
You know, if you were to travel the rails, you would be hitting Harvey houses out west, you know, the Fred Harvey companies, which I'm sure Howard Johnson's had to have looked at as inspiration.
Unquestionably, that was part of his research. And, you know, it's funny you should mention that, those adjacent roads, because, I mean, even on the Northway up toward you, you know, right along the Northway, you have US 9, which is where so much of that lovely wonderful kitsch that goes right through Lake George still survives. The remnants of Frontier Town, as you were saying earlier.
Santa's Village.
And all of that. Yeah, it's all that good stuff. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, and for a while there, I think the Northway, you know, I-89 ended not terribly far north of Saratoga. And so drivers would, up until like the 60s or so, would have to get off the highway and get onto Route 9. That was their only choice to go up further north. And no coincidence that those hotels I was mentioning before, and the neighborhood that was a Catholic summer school, is on Route 9. It's like right there. And, you know, early, I'd say by the 20s or 30s, they were starting to advertise out of those hotels that you could rent a car and even hire a driver to bring you around. And they had like different markers, like, you know, a drive to Lake Placid would be this much and take this amount of time, or up to Montreal, same thing. And then after a while, they were encouraging people to drive their cars. But by that point, people were like, why am I going to go to some old, you know, spend a week in a hotel if I can hit a Holiday Inn or a Hojo's and several, you know, go several different places and just, you know, go to these franchise motels.
The country. Get out there on the great American.
Yeah. Road. I mean, I that was why we did
it's
last
so funny.
Year.
There are so many,
it was that reason?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm like,
I
always wanted to see America.
Very similar to the one that. Yeah, I mean, you did what Kevin Wilson did, and had such a horrible experience. You know that he said, "We're going to create a system of motels so that I don't have another horrible experience like this again." It's going to be some really good lodging, and you know, it's interesting. One of the things that you notice, especially when you get out there on the highways and byways, is how many signs there are out there that were inspired by the Great Sign, where people often assume that those were former great signs that got repurposed. One of the more famous ones is on Route 66, the Munger Moss, which is just spectacular. And it is basically a clone of a great sign, but it was not a great sign. There are many, many more like that still to this day exists around the country. But if you want to see an actual great sign, there's two places you can go. You can see smaller versions of them, unfortunately, but they do exist at the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati, which, if you've never been, I just went and I had a couple of weeks ago, and a remarkable place. And then the Henry Ford Museum, of course, in Michigan has another one as well.
That sounds like a perfect place to,
utterly,
to have
just
one.
Spectacular.
They go hand in hand, right? You know,
yeah.
You know, autos and
they go hand in hand.
Yeah, exactly. You can't ask for a better, you know, correlation between the two. What we just did for the last while is take just a tiny slice, honestly, of American travel and, you know, lodging history and hospitality, because those two places came about when they did for that reason, but it's always been there. you know, and I think that especially here in the East, where I'm in New England and, you know, where you are in New York, every single time you see a tavern, you know, like people always, you know, paint them as like, whoa, a tavern was a meeting place where people, it's like, yeah, that's the same thing as what a hotel does now. You know, and I used to work at such a place in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it was it's a 18th century tavern, and you know, it was operation, it was in business in the late 18th century. And when people would ask me questions about it, they're like, so what kinds of things do people do here? And I would describe that they would, you know, eat, and there would be beds, and they would have newspapers, and you know, you'd get post op, you know, you get your mail here. Oh wow. I'm like, so, and I would usually be in the time period myself, so I couldn't compare it. But when I wasn't in that, you know, attire, I could talk to myself. I'm like,
we get the same.
We did. And I was like, so just imagine staying in a hotel. What do you get at a hotel? And even like a Howard Johnson's or a Holiday Inn, you get a breakfast in the morning, you know, you get your night stay. They usually have the news on TV in the breakfast area, and they, some places still have, you know, at least for a while had newspapers at your door, you know, or at least access to one. It was the exact same thing.
USA and, Today, baby.
Yeah, exactly. They had that, you know, because they knew that, I mean, it's always been there. It's not anything that was invented. It was just, I guess, adjusted for the changing times of the mid 20th century. And it seems like some of them held on and others didn't, but for the ones who didn't, we still have wonderful memories, or at least wonderful photographs and postcards. I always get a kick out of the postcards of motels. Yes. You know, like it seems ridiculous now that you can't find postcards, first of all, anymore. But when you do, it's usually of like pretty cool stuff. Not here's a crappy motel I stayed in, you know, just like, hi, I'm, you know, this is my room right there. you know, that's my little cabin that I was in. But
yeah, no, but people were proud of that little crappy motel they were in somewhere on some obscure road nobody travels on anymore. But that was a big deal in 1952.
Yeah, like, it was.
Hey, Aunt Gladys, look at me. This is where I am. Look at the pool.
I love coming across at antique stores old postcards, and just like I can't say no to them, especially if there's, and I think places like I went to a great antique store in Glens Falls a couple years ago, you know, right outside Lake George, and they had of course tons of postcards from that area, but also all over. And I think the vast majority of them have some kind of relationship with a hotel or motel, because they know that that's where you're going to be writing your postcard most likely. And, you know, they could send it out for you in the next day's post and everything. So even in that era, I can't thank you enough.
Our best and sometimes only pictures that we have.
Yeah, you're right.
Are those postcards.
Are the really nice, you know, well, you know, actual photographer. I think my greatest find, I've mentioned before on the show, but my greatest find was a postcard of a postcard factory. I just thought that was the best, you know, very meta, like heavily this meta. Is where this was made. Like, if you look closely, you can see this one coming off the line. I can't thank you enough for taking the time with me today.
That's right.
And, you know, doing this, and, obviously, you know, at the beginning of the show, we talked about your Instagram. What is kind of your, you know, as people want to follow you on there as a retroologist, do you have like,
yeah, so basically,
what's on the horizon? What do you see?
And I use as retroologist, but I think basically doubling to continuing to work on the Instagram. I've got a new newsletter through Substack, and I'm trying to grow that. It is a subscription newsletter, and there's a paid component. So people want to support me and get additional services from me, you know, you can do that as well. I'm tinkering with the idea of a book. Hopefully that comes along. And it would be great if at some point this could branch into some kind of a video series or some kind of a television series. Who knows? I mean, but I think there's certainly potential there for something that's even more robust than what I'm doing right now, which seems hard to conceive of because this is already taking so much time and effort. Right. But I'm super thrilled and excited about it. And you know, and again, as long as I'm this passionate about it, I'm going to make sure that it keeps growing and that I keep giving people the kind of content that they're looking for, that they seem to enjoy so much.
I think it's all about, and you mentioned earlier about Burger King. You know, they've changed a lot of their signage back to the 80s Burger King appearance. And I think that
Very
is
smart.
Exactly why people love your site so much, is because it has, I mean, it's on Instagram. You can't get much more cutting edge than Instagram, but it's like one foot in the nostalgia and another foot in the future. So it's like a perfect combination. And Rolando Pujol, I can't thank you enough for being on the EPS podcast, where everything, including Holiday Inn and Howard Johnson's, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time, everybody.
Absolutely.
Instagram exists for people like the retrologist Rolando Pujol. His constant chronicling of what is staying put and what is leaving the American roadside is what I love about the app. And if you are one of the 96,000 people who follow him, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Beautiful images with interesting news and information of 20th century commercial buildings and signage are regularly posted by the retrologist, brightening up and enriching the internet each time. I can only hope to make half the positive impact on roadside interpretation and preservation as Rolando, but I will say that I gained many listeners as a result of the collaboration, and through this episode I was put in touch with Jeremy Ebersol and the Society for Commercial Archaeology. These have proved to be wonderful connections and resulted in some excellent Everything is a Primary Source conversations. You can find Rolando on Instagram as the Retrologist, and I'm at the_EPS_podcast. Follow me there on Facebook, YouTube, Patreon, and Substack. Until next time, this is the EPS Podcast, where everything, including Hojo's and Holiday Inn, is, once again, a primary source.